Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Presents Copla Connections, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. This is episode 59 and we are looking at John Lee Hancock's The Founder. If you're new to this here podcast, what we do here is we watch every single film in the collective Copla family filmography to determine if they are the greatest film family of all time. I don't do that alone, however. I am joined by a guest, and that is no different today when I'm joined by Harley Mumford from the Fundamentals podcast to have a lovely chat all about this, I don't know, I think underrated film that kind of slipped under the radar and kind of maybe got hamstrung by its marketing, but we get all into that in this chat and inevitably talk about all things McDonald's and our love-hate relationship as a kind of global society with that burger behemoth that is McDonald's. But it's a fun one. I'm sure you will enjoy it. As ever, there are spoilers throughout this chat. If you haven't seen it, head on over to Amazon Prime, which I believe it is streaming right now. But with all of that out of the way, all that's left to do is to head up and down the highway looking to sell some mixers, stumble upon an amazingly efficient burger joint and make some Copla connections. On this episode, we're hitting the road to sell some multi-mixers as we talk about the based on a true life story drama, The Founder, directed by John Lee Hancock and written by Robert Siegel. The film stars Michael Keaton, Nick Offerman, John Carroll Lynch, Linda Cardellini, BJ Novak and Laura Dern. Carter Burwell provides the score and the cinematography is from our boy, our Copla connection for this episode, John Schwartzman. Joining me to discuss the film and to see whether we hated it or we're loving it, and help me decide if the Coppola family are a solid square meal of Hollywood entertainment or just cheap and nasty fast food that will leave us feeling sick, is the host of the Fundamentals podcast, Harley Mumford. How are you, Harley?
I'm really good. Loving that intro, by the way. That's amazing.
Thank you. I got right to the end and I realized I feel like probably any podcast that's ever talked about this film has probably done a I'm loving it joke. I was like, might as well get it right up the front.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, that's going to be eating away from me throughout the whole episode. I had to just kind of get it out of my system.
Yeah. It's like McDonald's. You know what you're getting. It's fine.
Exactly. It's cheap. It's nasty. But yeah, we'll get on to whether that this film is that, or if it, I don't know, if there's a bit more to chew over. Let's just keep the food-based puns rolling throughout the episode as well.
I'll do my best. Yeah.
So before we do talk about the founder today, tell us a little bit about your podcast. Let's kind of hear about that up the front. I know most people hold it out until the end, but I don't know. Yeah. I'm not letting people off the hook for just skipping the end. Let's hear about what you do up front.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, let's get the shameless plugs out of the way early. That's fine. Yeah, so I run Fundamentals. It is the podcast that explores pop culture one conversation at a time. Basically, I invite guests on to talk about all manner of topics within pop culture. It can be film related, can be TV, can be music, sports, etc. Yourself and many other people have been on the podcast. A good example is, you, Petros. You came on back when I had a run of sitcom episodes that just sort of happened one summer. And yeah, we had an amazing conversation about Seinfeld, and I have since watched all of Seinfeld and absolutely loved it. So yes. Great things can happen with this podcast if you give it a listen.
Amazing. Yeah, it is such a fun way to, I don't know, to discuss things that you enjoy. I really enjoy the podcast, not just as a guest, but as a listener as well. Kind of, I think it can be quite telling as well, and go, oh, like there's people I know that have been on the podcast, but I didn't realize they were like such a big fan of that, for instance. Or like, you can get, even people you don't really know, it's just like a nice way to get an insight into people's passions, and really pulls out the most of people when you get them talking about something they like, right?
That's the aim. That's kind of how it all started. I was in lockdown. I was like, oh man, I miss these conversations with people, and they just sort of hit me, why not try a podcast? And I agree. I think those are the best conversations, and it's a space to learn. It's taught me a lot. You know, I've had so many guests that have come on that have talked about topics where I know nothing about them. Seinfeld, again, I was like, yeah, I'm aware of it. I don't really know much about it. And then by the end of it, I've gained all of this insight, and hopefully the listener has too. It's like, oh, that's why this thing is so popular. That's why people love it. And I always say, worst case scenario, you listen to an episode and you learn something. Best case scenario, you listen and you think, that sounds pretty cool. I should go and check that out.
I think that's what we're all hoping, right? Is that they go, maybe I'll give that film another chance. That's what I'm always hoping. Or I didn't think about that film in that way before.
Absolutely.
Again, before we talk about the founder, I want to know about your relationship to the Coppola family, and what was your entry point to the Coppola family? Was there a specific family member? And after that, when did you become aware that they were this behemoth of media and entertainment?
I want to say it's Nicolas Cage is the entry point. I don't exactly know when, but I know I would have watched some of his movies, probably like the National Treasure stuff, you know, at a younger age. And seeing things like Con Air, stuff like that's always on TV. And then I remember hearing, it's kind of like a well-known sort of movie trivia fact now, isn't it, that, you know, did you know that Nicolas Cage is related to the Coppola family? And you're like, oh, okay, you know. And by that point I'd seen The Godfather and things like that, and I was like, oh right, they're connected. That's cool. And I have to admit, actually, Petros, I owe a lot of it the sprawling aspect of it to yourself. You know, after speaking to you and learning about your podcast, I had a look, and it was just quite eye-opening to realize, oh, there's all these other connections. Like, you know, I knew Talia Shire, for example, from the Rocky franchise, had no idea that she was connected to them. And what's his name? He plays the villain in Scott Pilgrim versus the World. I know you've done that.
Maybe. Jason Schwartzman. Yeah.
That's the one. Jason. I was like, oh, I had no idea he was connected as well. And like you say, all these threads start to get pulled.
Yeah. And what you start to find as well is, and what I found is, just by looking at timelines of things, it seems to be when people step into the family. So John Schwartzman's a prime example. So he is Jack Schwartzman's son from a previous marriage before Talia Shire. But he was an agent in Hollywood and then started a production company once he had married Talia Shire, which felt like a step closer to the filmmaking aspect of things. And then obviously being around that, you could imagine John Schwartzman would have been, I don't know, inspired and kind of like, almost being like swallowed into this family that is the Coppolas. It's like, oh, so Francis is making films. You've got my cousin Nicolas Cage making films. Like, and then he's like, oh yeah, I'll give it a chance as well. And I think one of the reasons John's definitely on the list, even though like, people might be like, oh, there's not, that's no blood relation. It's like, I saw Nicolas Cage refer to him once as my cousin John Schwartzman because he was the cinematographer on The Rock. So yeah,
I think so.
So he was like, yeah, so Cage referred to him as his cousin. I'm like, I'm taking that. There's a lot of films I can talk about with John Schwartzman. Have you ever had the opportunity, Harley, to meet a Coppola at all, whether you know it or not? Have you ever been in the same room?
I don't think so. I mean, you never know, right? But I think not on this occasion. I mean, I would love to meet them. I hear that, for example, Nicolas Cage is quite a fascinating guy just to talk to. So I kind of feel like that would be a really interesting and unique opportunity. But, you know, even with the families, I just any of them, just to know that they're part of this huge Hollywood family, as you say, all these people they know, the industry they work in. I'd love to meet them. I'm sure it'd be a fascinating conversation.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, yeah. I've interacted with one of them on social media and I'm like, whoa,
nice.
Like, that enough. And obviously my kind of, one of my many, like, I don't know, end goals with this podcast is to interview as many of them as I can without like,
absolutely,
without seeming like, I don't know, some absolute freak. Do you know what I mean? Where it's like they think I've just got like a nutty room full of pictures of them all over the place. I know a lot about the family, but through the films, I kind of, the personal life and stuff like that, I ingest what's kind of in books, but I'm not so much into the kind of like TMZ kind of like what's Nicolas Cage having for breakfast on a Tuesday? Like,
gotcha.
I know the Daily Mail posted like a video of like Nicolas Cage drunk in a bar, and like on principle, I was like, I'm not watching it. Like, that's not what I'm about. Like, I'm not kind of feeding into this. Like, I don't know. Yeah, like circus freak show that certain publications tried to make of celebrities. Yeah. Let the work speak for itself.
Oh, absolutely. I agree. I mean, that whole sort of industry or the side of the industry is a bit ugly anyway, isn't it, really? Just the whole like unpicking of people's personal lives. It's like you say, just who cares, frankly? Mm-hmm. Just let them get on with the professional stuff. And to be honest with you, Petros, I think if anyone deserves to have the Coppolas on this podcast, it's the man who's dedicated an entire podcast to the family.
I've tried to have Nicolas Cage on the podcast.
One day, you never know. I think he's eccentric enough to do it, mate. Honestly, I think if you catch him in the right mood, he'd be like, "Yeah, why not? Let's do it." I'll talk to you about dinosaur skulls and Superman for 2 hours, and he'd be like, "Yeah, cool, go for it."
Watch this space. I'll try my hardest, ladies and gentlemen. So what would have been the first film you would have seen that had some involvement from John Schwartzman? I know this one more than, say, other members of the family requires a bit of digging on your part. So did you do the digging? Yeah. What did you figure out?
I had a quick look, through his IMDb, and I think it might have been The Blind Side.
Uh-huh.
I'm pretty sure that's the one. I remember watching that years ago. And obviously that was quite a big film, wasn't it? You know, did it win an Oscar, or it was nominated? I think some people in it were anyway. I remember when that came around and watching that. I had no idea. Again, no idea that he was behind the camera on that one.
Wait, is that's John Lee Hancock. Is John Schwartzman the DOP on that one? I'm just trying to figure this
wrong.
Out.
Hang on a second. No, you could be right and I could be wrong. This happens a lot. I've even come up with my own jingle on my podcast for when I'm wrong to stop the podcast. It happens a lot.
I'm kind of going through my like mind palace of the.
I am not going to argue with you. Trust me.
No. I may be wrong on this point.
There are people screaming at their
devices. Yeah, but I'm not sure how many like big DOP heads there are. Do you know what I mean? Like the people who are out there.
Oh, they exist. Don't you worry about that. If there's one thing I've learned doing podcasts about things in pop culture, people are extremely, extremely particular about all manner of things. Let's have a look. Okay, no, sorry. This is my mistake. So I'm just having a little look through now. Apologies, everyone. I am wrong. It was John Lee Hancock. So I'm aware of him from doing that movie. But having a look at this. When did I see? I'll tell you what it might have been, actually. Just looking at this, I reckon. This is weird. I have a feeling it might have been either The Green Hornet or Night at the Museum 2.
Amazing. Amazing. I think it's
also The Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man, I would have seen. But yeah, whichever one of those. Oh, so Night at the Museum 2 came out first. Yeah, so I would have been that, I think.
Amazing.
Yeah. And then I think, National Treasure. Oh, there's also a National Treasure movie. So maybe that as well. One of those, any one of those, pick one out of a hat. It would have been one of them.
Amazing. Amazing. So. We did you notice a kind of like visual style that he had? Because I always seem to think that like John Schwartzman is a really great kind of jobbing director of photography as opposed to...
Yeah, I mean, now that I think about it, I think about those movies and I think about this film that we're going to talk about. Yeah, it feels a bit like a sort of Ron Howard safe pair of hands kind of guy, you know.
Yes.
Like does a great job, it looks professional, it looks good, but nothing really stands out.
Yes, he's fitting the brief, right? He's kind of like a director's cinematographer as opposed to like,
yes,
oh, like we need this look, we'll get this like cinematographer in or something like that. Or like,
yeah, I'm just trying to think who's the oh, this is bugging me. It's one of my favorites, and I've completely blanked on his name.
Roger Deakins, the kind of like
Deakins,
the
Deakins,
the Elvis of the Elvis of cinematographers, the kind of like,
yes,
the goat.
Yeah.
And I guess there's an element with cinematographers as well that they're doing the right job if they're kind of, I don't know, not unnoticeable. Yeah, if they're kind of like, they're doing a fine job if they're unnoticeable. If you're kind of noticing, oh, that's really poorly lit, or like,
that's true,
that's framed terribly, then they're doing a bad job. Or if they're like too flashy, do you know what I mean? If they've
I know what you mean. Yeah, if it's just so much that you can't really work out what's going on, or yeah. You're like, why do we have Dutch angles for all of these scenes? Like that.
Not normally that's a director's fault, the Dutch angles.
True,
like, yeah, we're just going to just throw them in.
It makes conversations interesting.
So let's talk about The Founder. But before we do, let's listen to the trailer.
I know what you're thinking. How the heck does a 52-year-old, over-the-hill milkshake machine salesman build a fast food empire with 1,600 restaurants and an annual revenue of $700 million. One word. Persistence.
Prince Castle Sales.
Hi, Jim.
Ray, how's it going down there?
Good. Swell. A lot of interest.
We got an order. 6 mixers.
To anyone in particular?
McDonald's.
McDonald's?
Care for a little tour?
We wanted something different, and that's when my brother here comes up with one of his brilliant ideas.
Orders ready in 30 seconds, not 30 minutes.
Unique, original, there's nothing like this.
It's revolutionary.
That's exactly what it is, it's revolutionary. What is that?
The Golden Arches.
It's a way to make the place stand out.
Huh. There should be McDonald's everywhere. Franchise the damn thing.
What's the first step?
Just leave that to me. That glorious name, McDonald's. I have to have it.
Did you mortgage our home?
We could lose everything.
Good things come to those who wait.
Business is war. It's dog eat dog. I could be growing this thing at twice the pace.
I don't know what to say.
Say you'll renegotiate.
I can't.
Can't or won't?
What you ought to be doing is owning the land upon which that burger is cooked. You're not in the burger business. You're in the real estate business.
There's a wolf in the hen house.
We let him in.
Isn't enough going to be enough for you?
Honestly, never. Business is war.
It's dog eat dog, rat eat rat.
To succeed. To win.
Opportunity.
Sky's the limit.
You have a contract.
This is not your company, Ray.
You sure about that?
So, The Founder was released on January 20th, 2017, and was made for a budget of $25 million with a box office return of 24.1. In this chat, we'll get into some legal disputes that happened with this film, like the McDonald brothers and Ray Kroc. Things did go legal. In this case, the brothers in question who were getting sued were the Weinstein brothers, who, if you ask me, are two brothers who fucking deserve it. So before we get into all of the litigation and things that went on with this film, Harley, can you do us the pleasure of telling us what The Founder is all about?
I mean, in a sentence, it's the story of how Ray Kroc basically stole a business from two brothers and turned it into a multi-billion dollar franchise.
Yeah, so this is the story of McDonald's, right? This is I'm not sure about you is, because some of the branding for this film and like the posters have the McDonald's arches on them, which like, I'm not sure if it's through my ignorance. I was like, surely that's copyrighted. Like that kind of M is copyrighted. Cause I did some digging and like, in an interview with John Lee Hancock, he kind of said like McDonald's didn't obviously have anything to do with this. Cause it kind of doesn't portray them in a particularly good light to some degree, especially with kind of Ray Kroc. Yes, you said stealing the business from Mac and Dick Donald.
Mm. Yeah, I was wondering that because, you know, it's funny, about almost a year ago now, I had a guest MJ Smith on my podcast talking about biopics. And we brought this movie up as a good example of the kind of biopic you get where it's about, you know, a business owner and these guys that build these huge empires, and they're kind of either a very glossy, glamorized kind of version of events, or they're a warts and all story. And yeah, this is definitely a warts and all. And I had that exact thought actually of, yeah, I wonder how much McDonald's were kind of involved or how happy they were with a lot of this. I suppose it's one of those things because it's art, because it's movies, they can't really, can they really get involved? Can they really stick their lawyers in too much and say, no, please don't make this movie, or do they have to kind of back off? But that's a good point about the logo. Yeah, I would have thought that would have come under some sort of copyright or fire, but did you find anything on that?
No. I guess it's fair game. I guess like,
yeah, maybe
you can tweak it ever so slightly that it's kind of, do you know what I mean? It's like, if it could just be a fault, like, do you know what I mean? It's like, you can't.
It's like the slightly different color or something.
the arch is not as arched as it is. Or do you know what I mean? It's a bit more arched than it is from McDonald's. Maybe they've just kind of, they've done
ours
that.
Ours is 110 like, degrees. Yours is 112, you know? Yeah, something
exactly,
like that. Yeah.
Exactly. They probably, it's like Audi. They've got the design department next to legal going, change it ever so slightly. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're called Prangles, not Pringles, okay? He's got a mustache. Yeah. This guy's got a goatee. It's different.
Yeah. Exactly right. Amazing.
I want to preface that by saying that I love Aldi, and it is a great supermarket chain.
Was it Aldi or Lidl got into like a huge thing with M&S over some sort of like caterpillar cake? Do you remember that? That was all over Twitter.
Yeah, Colin the Caterpillar. Yeah, and that's got one. Yeah, and then kind of all of the supermarkets have their own version of the caterpillar cake, and it kind of became like the battle of
they all like ganged up on Marks and Spencer's. It was hilarious.
Well, yeah, it wasn't a good look for Marks and Spencer's, because I think, and it kind of pertains to this film somewhat, is Marks and Spencer's kind of, I guess for me as well, as like a working class lad from Crawley. You get this like image of like Marks and Spencer's is like hoity-toity money. Do you know what I mean? It's almost very like the so. Like yeah. the they're like the Ray Crocs coming after like the cheap and affordable Audi, and it's like, well, maybe families can't afford like £8 for your caterpillar cake, but can afford £2 for the Audi version. It's like, you just kind of...
Yeah. I agree, yeah.
Very, very Tory behaviour, that's what it was.
It's the marketing equivalent of kicking a puppy, yeah. It's like,
exactly.
Come on.
Exactly, yeah. It's like pulling up in a Rolls Royce to a food bank and taking food off of a starving child, the bastards.
so good.
So talking about thieving bastards, when did you first see the founder, and what were your kind of initial impressions? Did you kind of were you amped up for the film before it came out, or did you kind of were you blindsided, to quote a John Lee Hancock title, when you did see it?
To just highlight my mistake even more, yeah. So yeah, I saw this film, I want to say about, I think a couple of months after it came out in the cinema. It's one of those I wanted to see, but at the time I just couldn't get around to it. And then it popped up on Prime, and it's pretty much stayed there ever since. Because, you know, I went to rewatch it, obviously, for this. And then found it was still on there. So yeah, just kind of dove straight in. I was interested in it, just hearing that, like I said earlier, it's a biopic. It's about this story that is quite a well-known kind of bad guy story, you know, in terms of business, as you say. It's not a good story at all, really, from their point of view. And the fact that it was Michael Keaton in the lead role just made me think, okay, this is going to be interesting at the very least. Let's check it out.
So... had you known about the Ray Kroc story before watching the film? Or
I knew about it for two reasons. The first actually leads me onto a point I was going to make earlier, but I'll make it now, is it's the subject matter of one of my favorite Dire Straits songs.
Okay.
It's a song called Boom Like That. It's a really great song, really simple bluesy song Mark Knopfler wrote. And it is literally him telling this story.
Amazing.
There's even lines in this movie where he says like dog eat dog, rat eat rat. That's a like a chorus line in the song. I think there's another line that he says, I made a note of it actually. Michael Keaton says, if they're gonna drown, put a hose in their mouth, which is quite a dark line.
Mm-hmm.
That's a line in the song. And so sort of when I heard that, I was like, oh, that's what that song's about. Cool. And then I went and listened to some podcasts and some other YouTube documentaries sort of on the history of it. And was really interested to learn the actual story and go, oh man, that's brutal. So yeah, learning all of that and then finding out that there's a movie coming out about it was great, I thought.
Well, because the initial story we get within this of like the actual birth of McDonald's as a company, it's like really heartwarming. Like, I found myself like, I don't know, like getting a bit like watery-eyed, like listening to it. And it's kind of like quite like, life affirming, like listening to these two guys like really trying to struggle their way through, having aspirations to make it in Hollywood and finding a way to like have this business and basically revolutionizing fast food. But then it's like a bitter sweetness for it, especially like living in 2023, seeing what McDonald's has become. And it's like,
sure, man,
listening to them kind of talk about their homesprung ideas, and Dick McDonald is very much like, oh, I'm not like into capitalism and stuff like that. And it's like, that's all McDonald's is now, Dick.
Yeah. It almost feels like they could have their own movie, right? Like it feels like you're joining on to it's like a sequel in a way. It feels like they've had a life prior to him coming along. Yes. And like you say, all the stuff that happens, that whole montage and like backstory of where they came from, as you say, is so heartwarming and so multifaceted and interesting that you think, yeah, I kind of would love to see their origin story as a full movie. Would be kind of cool. And I really like that scene, actually. Just maybe reminded me of the bit where they're in the tennis court and they're like doing the sort of rehearsal and trying to work out. It's amazing. It's so good. And like you say, it's just so heartwarming to watch. You're like, oh, good for you guys. Like, doing all of that, taking your employees out, doing all the research and the investment and doing it off your own back. Like you say, you're really rooting for them, which makes it such an odd movie in the way that then they're not the protagonists.
Yeah. So do you think that the filmmakers, obviously the writer Robert Spiegel, what am I looking for here? Siegel. Robert Siegel. Do you think he made the right decision by framing this as the Roy Kroc story?
I think so, yeah, because in fairness with them, it's had Ray Kroc never really entered the picture with McDonald's, you kind of think, where would their story have gone? You imagine they would probably just be a very successful, localized, maybe national kind of fast food chain. As they say, they had a couple of chains up and down the country, you know, like in the state. That's probably as far as it would have gone. Whereas the real story of like, how does it become this behemoth of industry? Well, the answer is kind of a sad one, and the story is quite an ugly one. So it's one that you do have to tell. And yeah, I don't know about you. I think it's a really interesting performance by Michael Keaton in this. Not only the accent and the way he performed, like I just think the moment you're introduced to the guy, I feel like they set him up straight away as what he is, which is just a pushy salesman.
Yeah, well, it's like
too much ambition.
It's this swing of he's like he's a doorstepper, right? He's like that. Yeah. I was reading a book fairly recently about a writer called Larry Grindel, and he was talking about how his first job was being like an encyclopedia salesman, like door to door.
Oh wow! And okay,
I immediately thought of like that when I was watching this, like that kind of, you've got to be that kind of person. Or I'm not sure if you've ever seen the film Glengarry Glen Ross, where they're trying to like sell insurance to people.
I haven't, but I'm aware. Isn't it like the coffees for closers thing?
Yes. Yeah. So like people who are like that and like kind of don't let you, do you know what I mean? You imagine if you go to close the door, they stick their foot in to kind of like, oh, one more thing. Like they give you the Columbo and just trying to close the deal. And the way that Michael Keaton is presented to us as well, with him basically just like speaking directly to us at the beginning, it is kind of like an arresting way to get the audience in. You're like, okay, what's this guy's deal?
Definitely. It's interesting because I used to work in sales and I do kind of recognize a lot of the traits there. He's very much in the pushy category, and it's sort of like the backhanded compliments, the stuff that he picks up along the way from other people and like claims as his own. It's a sort of air of desperation about the guy throughout the entire movie, which is really interesting. And I love that they kind of layer that in, as you say, almost from like that opening monologue where he's just talking at you and you almost feel like you're boxed in. And it's like, you're immediately put in the position of a business owner and this guy's just in your face trying to shove this machine on you. And you're kind of like, oh man, it's 2 minutes in, I'm already sick of you.
I think what's really interesting is John Lee Hancock said, like, I was watching some interviews with him, and he said he looked at the film as almost like a bit of a Rorschach test for where your kind of allegiances lie. And like, it's this kind of interesting thing. Because I think to begin with, and it kind of, I think they play about with it in the kind of filmmaking and the way the things they choose to show us of Ray Kroc's life, with him kind of, he seems a bit of a, he's got ambition. Yeah, he might be a bit pushy, but is that because he's like, it could go either way? I think without, especially as somebody, when I first watched it, I didn't really know the machinations of the plot or where, what the end goal was and how he kind of like screwed them over. Because, and there's this, I think there's an element of, I'm watching it a second time as well, kind of looking at the filmmaking and the way that they've done it to show us who he is. You do get this idea that, oh, maybe he's just a guy who, I don't know, he could be close to bankruptcy, and he's just really, do you know what I mean? He seems a bit beaten down and a bit like, oh, is this ever gonna go my way? Like, he's a man in his 50s, in the 1950s. So like, you would have thought people, especially in that time in America, would have been starting to maybe like wind their lives down a bit. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like imagine retirement age would have been a bit younger. Like, yeah. And we realized quite early on, especially with interactions with Ethel played by Laura Dern, like he's this guy who's always been chasing these kind of get rich quick schemes and kind of trying to, trying to make a fast buck and always flitting on to the next thing. And when he presents her the idea of McDonald's, it's like, oh, what's it now, Ray? Like, what have you got yourself into this week kind of deal?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I agree. It's, I feel like a really strong theme of this movie is it's like contentment versus ambition. Mm-hmm. And like you say, it could go either way. It's because when you're initially presented with what the McDonald's brothers have done, like as you said, it's heartwarming, it's impressive. You're like, this is brilliant. And you do kind of think, yeah, franchise it. Yeah, have more of these things. If you run it right, it makes money, it's easy. But then when they explain their side of it, you kind of go, oh yeah, I can see how that would be a problem. And it's just the way that he keeps pushing through. And like the stuff with Ethel, like you say, played by Laura Dern. I mean, poor Laura Dern. Like she's amazing in this movie, but you just feel so sorry for the whole movie. Like, as you said, he's surrounded by her. He's got all of his friends in that little country club. You know, everybody's kind of winding down. Even when he like, tries to sell on franchises to his mates there, they're not really that bothered by it. They're kind of like, we've already got our money. We're out here playing golf. Like, but he's just all riled up and, for him, it's everything. It's this like this desperation, like you say, to be something else. And it's so fascinating that you've got that versus what's actually in his life, which is like, dude, you've got money, you've got a nice house, you've got a wife that loves you. You know, like that's the American dream.
Yeah.
But it's not enough for him. And it's just quite interesting how far he then goes off into the deep end towards the end.
And I think what they cleverly have done in this film as well is Ethel and Ray Kroc in real life had a daughter, but I think by like getting rid of the daughter for the film, kind of like, it's like an unnecessary, it would have added like an unnecessary element to the film that didn't need to be there, almost in a kind of like Ray Kroc way of like, how can we make this more streamlined? Do you know what I mean? Like,
that's true. And you already don't like the guy enough. You don't need to add that in the mix as well.
Well, yeah. I can imagine, and it's interesting because this film was made, I believe it was actually like shot and made like 2015. So like predates the rise of Donald Trump to presidency. And by the time this came out, this would have been what? Basically as he was like inaugurated as president. And I think it very much plays upon that without meaning to, because it is a man who kind of, through an understanding of branding and name recognition, managed to basically game his way from like being like a New York crooked businessman to basically being the 45th president of the United States. And it's like, it made the film like ridiculously pertinent. And you can imagine people like Donald Trump watching this film. And that's why I was saying like how it does work as a Rorschach test. It's people kind of cut from that cloth will watch this and go, Ray's just doing what Ray's got to do to get the job done.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. Probably is. Yeah, you're very much correct there. I think, it would say a lot about your personality type if you don't have an issue necessarily with how things go down. But yeah, it's, I just find it really, really interesting that they were happy to go down that road. But then at the same time, these kinds of movies do come around quite a lot now. I mean, you've got, what is it, like The Social Network, you've got both Steve Jobs movies, you know, it's, you know, and now everything that's kind of going on with, as you say, Donald Trump, Elon Musk, all these people. And it does feel like Hollywood in fiction for the longest time has had the billionaire businessman as like the bad guy. I mean, hell, even the Lego movie has Lord Business, right? Like it's sort of there in our consciousness. So for this film to come out, as you say, during that time, and even now, it's something that we sort of recognize, I think, as a part of us, as a society, is now more aware of, can sort of look at and go, yeah, this is pretty much what you have to become if you want to become one of the wealthiest people in the world, is you have to step on a whole lot of people and a whole lot of dreams on the way up.
And I think we're living in a time as well where like people are more and more happy to watch entertainment, whether it's film or TV, that is centered upon bad people. Like, do you know what I mean? Kind of people, like, you look at, like the Jeffrey Dahmer show on Netflix was like the most watched show ever. And it's like, as much as they try and profess that like, we're doing it from the perspective of the victims, like, no, you're not. You make it like, do you know what I mean? You're doing sexy Jeffrey Dahmer with Evan Peters. It's like, you're not doing that. And people seem to have this kind of like, almost like watching a car crash mentality to the things they enjoy. And I think like, this plays into it somewhat. And I think it does, it does kind of, I think the most similar thing probably is like The Social Network. Or you look at TV, like we've had like Pam and Tommy, we have WeWork and stuff like that. I think people are fascinated by these true life stories, especially when it's packaged up kind of sometimes like the warts are there, or they're put into more palatable, do you know what I mean? Like all of the boring bits are kind of skimmed off the top, and we're given like the kind of, I don't know, like packaged burger. We're getting the two pickles, perfect squirt of mustard and ketchup, and some onions version, as opposed to the kind of like sloppy. Here's everything. Here's the full menu. No, we're keeping it pared down. That's what we're getting. You mentioned, like Michael Keaton was a big draw for you. In my research for this, I saw that initially it was offered to Tom Hanks. What do you think of that as a prospect for casting? Do you think this would have been a better or a worse movie for Tom Hanks being in it?
I am fascinated by that. I tell you for why. Because I feel like at this time, right, Michael Keaton's the perfect fit because he's back. He's done like Birdman. He's doing action movies. He's doing all sorts of stuff, right? He's sort of back in a big way. And we know that he can play these kinds of characters. He can do slimy characters. He can do villains. He can do aggressive sort of characters and all that stuff. Tom Hanks is basically America's uncle at this point. Mm-hmm. But having said that, I would love to see him take on a role like this, you know, because he is so charming and we associate him with that kindness so much. I kind of would love to see him play a villain. I mean, He sort of did, right? Like he played
Colonel Tom Parker in Elvis. Like he's basically the villain of that as well.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, he's Colonel Tom Parker, as well as Walt Disney. I mean, I know Mr. Banks is, you know, he's sort of a gentle hand in the movie, but imagine Tom Hanks returning to that role, but in a more honest, like sort of brutally confronting version of his life story, very much like The Founder. That would be awesome. I would pay good money to see that.
Yeah. And I think Michael Keaton, you can see as like being like the perfect second choice of this. Like, I think it would have been interesting for Tom Hanks to do it, especially at that time. It would have been leaning a bit further into, like you said, he played Walt Disney, but like that film is very much sanctioned by the Disney company. So it's kind 100%. Of like, that a version of Saving Mr. Banks, not made by Disney, has Tom Hanks smoking in it. The one made by Disney has like kind of allusions that he smokes, and it's like, no, we can't have smoking on screen. Like, this needs to be a PG. This is a family movie. And I'm sure that some of the arguments he probably had with P.L. Travers were a lot more like heated and like, I don't
big time.
Yeah. There's a lot more like effing and jeffing going on than we see in that. But like, obviously, that's the Disneyfied version of this, of that story. Whereas, Michael Keaton, he kind of comes with that baggage. And obviously around this time, I think when this would have been made, he's just come off the back of Spotlight as well. Oscar winning movie. Spotlight. I think if Birdman was like, he's back, Spotlight was like, and he's staying. Like,
absolutely. Yeah. And then makes sense, right? And like you say, the director of this movie having a bit of experience with Oscar-type movies, I get the sense from that when you watch this. I don't know if they were going for Oscar in this, but it feels a little like they were trying to play into the awards a little bit. The fact that it only grossed, what do you say, like 24 million? Like it didn't even make back its budget, I think kind of says that it didn't land, I'm guessing.
That, and with like the distribution being handled by the Weinstein Company, who are very, like, despite their flaws and like how like repugnant they are as people and the kind of acts they've done and the crimes they've done, have always kind of had a penchant for managing to get, they've always had a knack of getting films kind of that Oscar attention that it needs. And it kind of feels like they had no faith in this, seeing as it was released in January, which for years and years was kind of the dump month for a lot of films. It's kind of like they must have been putting their kind of all their chips on another film and went, we've got this. Nah, Keaton's kind of already done his thing of like, if this was his comeback film, maybe we probably would have seen like, oh, he's coming back and he's kind of, he's playing this conflicting character to the audience where it's like at the beginning, you're like, oh yeah, I can root for this guy. And then as soon as he kind of gets his first taste of success, is like an absolute monster, and we kind of see him evolve into this kind of monster who by the end of it is what is excited to have a kind of meeting with Ronald Reagan.
He's basically trying to go back on all of his contracts, go back on his word and his deals, his marriage, you know, like you said, everything just goes out of the window as soon as he knows that he can afford to just ditch everybody and move on to a, air quotes, better life that he envisions for himself.
So one of the things I wanted is the, obviously we talked about John Schwartzman earlier, and his kind of like, how he just fits a director's kind of look and stuff like that. But what did you think of the kind of camera work in this film? So obviously, like, when it came to filming in the like McDonald's locations, and have to definitely mention Michael Cronenblythe, the production designer on this, who kind of was tasked to basically recreate the McDonald's stores of that time, like kind of from the ground up. And they kind of used, on eBay, they managed to get like blueprints. And I think the oldest kind of still standing McDonald's location is one in Downey, California, that looks like that concept drawing that they have on their wall.
Like, right, okay.
That still exists to this day, like pretty much unchanged. But the ones they created, kind of the way they did it is they made, I think, one or two, but the way they did it is the kitchen could be changed around. It was kind of like little units that they could change around, so they could film in the same place, but it could kind of step in for every different franchisee location that he visits.
That's incredible, man. It's stuff like this in movie making that I'm fascinated by, and I'm glad you bring it up, because I don't think people give it enough attention, but that's awesome. That is absolutely awesome, isn't it, to think that far ahead and plan it. And it was, as far as how it looks on screen, I think it just looks amazing. Like you say, I never would have known that. Had you not told me that, I never would have known. I would have just assumed that they just built different locations and moved around and that was that. But they all just look stunning.
And the way that like the restaurants themselves were working. So like the grills actually worked. And John Lee Hancock said in an interview that to begin with, it was like, oh, great, we got like burgers on set. And I imagine it's like that thing of working at a McDonald's, like the first couple of weeks, it's like, hey, it's free lunches. And then like by like the end of the first month, you're like, I don't want to see another burger in the rest of my life.
The smell of a Big Mac just makes you want to vomit. I'd imagine so. But no, I think it's incredibly well done. And as I said earlier, that, you know, that whole like, from the tennis court scene to them like layering things up, he does all these bird's eye shots, and then it transitions into them in the restaurant for the first time, and everything's working like clockwork, and you've got the camera moving around and taking it all in. It's really well done. It's really well put together. It's so easy to follow. It's so intricate. And I definitely think it helps towards putting you into Ray Kroc's shoes of like seeing this machine just working so efficiently.
And hearing hearing that story as well, and like the kind of how like visualizing it, and you imagine that's how like Ray's imagination is visualizing it. This kind of like and it's exciting as well. Like I've like it's quite it's quite rare to think of food prep in films being made visual. Do you know what I mean? Like on paper, this could seem like quite a boring movie, but kind of
no, not at all.
Once you get into it, it's fun. Like it's kind of it whips along.
It is. It's always magical. I mean, even the contrast, right, between we only get like 10, 15 minutes of him at other places. But I was just thinking about it. They're kind of shot in very dim locations. You know, there's a lot of, they kind of look a bit run down. There's all this stuff. It seems chaotic. And then you get to the first McDonald's and it does feel like weirdly like a fast food Disneyland where like it's so clean and pristine and it's like it is a miracle. Like he gets there. Everyone's happy. It looks open. It's a blue sky.
Well, it's like that oasis in the desert, isn't it?
Yeah,
like,
everyone's happy. And then within 30 seconds, bang, he's got the burger. And you're just as surprised as he is watching it because you're like, wait, no, that can't be right. And, you know, and all the families are all happy and clean and tidy. It is like so well set up and shot that it really, yeah, fair play to them. They really do a great job of selling this to you as an audience.
I feel like this is the only time I'm ever going to be able to voice this bugbear of mine.
Go on.
But I have found, as somebody who like occasionally goes to a McDonald's, obviously, I think they're an evil corporation, but sometimes you're kind of stuck for choices. I very much enjoy a McPlant, even more so now it's a double McPlant. But seeing this film and the kind of joy on his Ray's face when he gets the burger in 30 seconds is like, I could only dream of a time when that was the case. It's like, I go into McDonald's now and they know it as well. They're like, oh, do you just want to bring it over? Do you want table service? It's like, because they know, like, yeah, you're going to be waiting 20 minutes. And I think, I've been thinking about this a lot, Harley. I think it's that they haven't got the infrastructure for delivery. I think that's where they're going wrong. They're getting Uber Eats on board. They're getting Just Eat, but they ain't got the infrastructure for it. The McDonald brothers will be turning in their grave at what has happened to their joyous speedy system. I tell you that 100%. For sure.
I think everybody knows now that unless you're going in the drive-thru, you're waiting like 10, 15, 20 minutes for your food. Nah, for sure.
A big question I have for you, Harley, is what is your McDonald's order?
I was going to ask you the same thing, so I'm glad you brought it up. Funny thing for me these days, it's not a lot. The main thing I get from McDonald's is honestly just a coffee, like because it's 99p, so you know that's fine by me. But if I'm getting food, probably I tend to go for like a wrap or just a burger. And that's kind of it. I don't really have a lot. I used to go all out. I used to be like big meal, you know, largest one, whatever the seasonal ones are, because they're always bigger. Milkshake and a McFlurry. And that's just the thought of that honestly turns my stomach now.
I remember. So when I went to see this film, so I saw this in the cinema, I remember like people will probably be rolling their eyes at me for saying this. I've changed my ways. Me and my ex-girlfriend would always like sneak a little McDonald's into the cinema with us to watch a film. We'd eat, you know, people frown upon that. It's naughty, but come on. Don't eat those stinky nachos. They're overpriced. I don't like them. So, like,
I was gonna say, like, what are your options in a cinema these days? I mean, if you're gonna sneak in, you know, a 99p,
yeah,
exactly, yeah. If you're gonna go and spend a fiver at McDonald's and actually get more food, then why not?
This is what I used to eat meat as well. So I remember my exact order I would have had when I went to see The Founder. I would have had 5-piece chicken select meal, large. With an Oasis, because I love me the little Summer Fruits Oasis. And then would have had one, maybe two, I'm not sure how I felt on this day, double cheeseburgers. I love those nice. Double cheeseburgers. That was kind of like my go-to. Nowadays it is very much, I'm on the McPlant. Maybe a little Coke Zero, depending on how I'm feeling. If I'm hungover, I'm paying that sugar tax and I'm getting that full fat. Or I'll get the summer fruits Oasis. Still.
That's fair. I think it's totally fair. It's just one for me that has, same as you, man. I've changed. I'm not a vegetarian or vegan, but getting into like the health and fitness scene a few years ago. And I got, fun fact about me, I got into weights like 5 years ago and just sort of educated myself on basic nutrition and like dropped a load of weight and all this stuff. And
McDonald's ain't the one.
Exactly. Yeah, you learn that's not very conducive. But there's nothing wrong with it by the same stretch. Like if you want to go for it, go for it. It's funny how it just changed my tastes. Hence why I mentioned I tend to go for singular items. Like yourself, I'll have a double cheeseburger or a wrap or something else. The one thing I've realized, I discovered that I can't do from McDonald's is fries, because the sodium in them just kills me now. I used to munch those down, no problem. And I remember just over a year or so ago, going to a gig, went to McDonald's on the way, picked up a cheeseburger, and my mate said, oh, do you want some of these? Yeah, okay. Do you know what? Still a bit peckish, I'll have some. Honestly, I felt hungover the next day.
Yeah, the salt. Yeah. That's why
it just hit me, man. I think my body was like, what is this? Where did this come from?
I knew that this podcast may become the McDonald's pod, and I'm gonna roll on this avenue.
Let's go for it.
Because little tip for you, ladies and gentlemen out there, if you ever want to make sure that your food is fresh at McDonald's, and I think it pertains to the chips as well, the way you do it is you order fries, no salt, and if you do want a little bit of salt, you ask for a sachet and you can do it yourself.
Yeah.
Or you could just have it without the salt, or just... If you don't like those, gherkins, don't pick them out. Order it without. Your burger is made fresh to order. You're not getting one of those ones that's like stinking up on the hot plate for like 30 minutes or something like that. You got one that's not sloppy. It's made to order. I find with the plant as well, because it seems that vegetarian and veganism hasn't prevailed as much as us guys would like.
Petros, you've got baby carrots now at McDonald's, don't you know? It's all good.
but that's still made to order, so it's always lovely and fresh when I go in there. So it's like, come on.
that is a great little hack. Yeah, actually, you just reminded me. A good mate of mine, Will, used to work in McDonald's, and I think he said something similar. Yeah, to that effect of, if you want it fresh, you've asked for something specific, and they'll have to do it from scratch.
That, and if you order two Happy Meals, it's like two. I think it's four piece. Four piece Happy Meals nuggets. You get eight nuggets cheaper than it would be to get a 9-piece nugget meal.
Hey, there you go. Interesting.
There you go. Don't even eat meat, but I'm still giving you the McDonald's hacks.
Life hacks with Petros.
Exactly. Nah, this made me think. Maybe I should have prepared some more kind of, I don't know. I don't really want to draw people to McDonald's. I've got enough
They're
money.
Doing all right. They're doing all right. They don't need our help. I wanted to ask you, actually, because I feel like it's quite interesting. The way that this is set up, as we said earlier, it doesn't really portray the whole company or business in a good light. But talking about, McDonald's as it is and fast food and all of that, I do feel like they've taken a real beating, in the last sort of decade or so, or a bit longer. I feel like, did you ever see that documentary? Oh, was it called Supersize Me?
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that being big as well.
It was big, and I feel like that really put a dent in them. And you kind of feel like ever since they've been sort of peddling backwards a little bit.
Have they? Know. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is massive.
Oh, no, it's still big, but you notice their marketing is a lot more like, we have carrots now and we like to fresh farm things. And it's sort of, you can tell they're trying to scoot around some of the damage that did
Yeah, it's still pretty evil. Like, that's the thing.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Yeah, like, yeah. They're just slapping a sticker on it and going, we've changed.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
No, you haven't. No, you haven't.
Yeah, I love the work of Dexter Fletcher, but I always want somebody in interviews to ask him, like, how much are you getting paid for voicing those McDonald's adverts? Because he's like the kind of yeah. de facto voice of the UK McDonald's
That's
adverts.
So true. That's so true.
How much are you getting paid, Dexter? That's he's like, oh, yeah, I can make a film. Do you know what I mean? I make
yeah. They're yeah. backing up a truckload of chicken McNuggets to his house just every yeah, couple of months.
Like, yeah, yeah, exactly. He's like, yeah, I'll get a
swim
film
in these,
out every...
Dexter.
Exactly. I'll make Rocket Man, but then yeah, I'll take it easy for a little bit. I got that McDonald's yeah. money coming in.
Yeah, I'm pretty set. It's all good. Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, we've talked about Michael Keaton's performance in this. Are there any other performances that stick out to you in this? Obviously, we have Nick Offerman and John Carroll Lynch as the McDonald's
yeah.
brothers.
What do you those think of those two? I mean, awesome, right? Like, just really sell it as just these guys who are just absolutely there to make, they're no fuss, no nonsense, but, you know, they've got their dream and they're sticking to it. It's kind of fascinating to me as well, looking at it, considering... Nick Offerman, I mean, I don't know when Parks and Rec ended, actually. That would have been around this time, I'd have thought. Mm-hmm. The only man that freaks me out when I see him without facial hair, like,
yeah.
it just looks unnatural, but he's sort of channeling Ron Swanson light in this. Like, he's very pragmatic, no nonsense, but he's not quite as extreme, but still really good, you know? And yeah, John Carroll Lynch, isn't he the guy in the Zodiac film that they think is the Zodiac killer? I'm pretty sure he's...
I'm doing a little fan theory here that this film is yeah. a prequel to Zodiac. Is that the sale of...
He snaps, yeah.
Yeah, he snaps. He snaps because he like, they had no choice but to sell their company to Ray Kroc.
Yeah, yeah. He yeah, goes on a killing spree. Yeah. We need to rewatch this movie right now and just see if he's wearing a Zodiac watch or something. Like, that would be the clue.
That is true. Yeah, he leaves.
It was there all along.
He just shifties on down to San Francisco. He's like, there yeah. he goes. I think the timeline works out as well.
Probably does.
There you go.
Yeah. I love them though. I think they're great. As I said earlier, like, Laura Dern's brilliant in it. Just really good as a sort of absolutely battered down housewife who's, bless her heart, is trying her best. You know, it breaks your heart the number of times in the film where she's just trying to nudge Ray along and just sort of get involved. Like, he complains about, you know, her not being a teammate and all the rest of it and just being really nasty. And then, you know, in the next scene we see her and she's there going, oh, I found these people who want to invest. And he's just like, no, forget about that. And you're just like, oh, poor love. Yeah. She's trying so hard.
Yeah, she's just kind of like, and I think that is the thing, like, this film is very much Ray's story, right? And like the kind mm-hmm. of, and I think the film does these like interesting things. In other films, I think would irk me slightly, but like, I kind of give this film a bit of a free pass just because it's kind of, it does that thing where you see like Ray look at something and like his eyes light mm-hmm. up and then like, mm-hmm. oh, plot point coming. Do you know what I mean? It's like yeah. when he's in the fridge at one point with or like the freezer and he's like, do you know what? My dad used to own a, like the guy's like, my dad used to own an ice cream company and it was the refrigeration that made him bankrupt. And you kind of see like, there's like the camera kind of goes yeah. into Keaton's face and it's like, oh, that's gonna come, and that kind of happens throughout the movie with certain things, and that's kind yes. of like the always like the next sticking point with the McDonald brothers.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, speaking of those moments, the whole thing with Linda Cardellini, right? Like, as soon as she shows up on screen, it's like his eyes just fixate, and it's pretty creepy, to be honest. Like the way he just kind of ogles her, like, in front of the man's, in front of her husband as well. Like, Patrick yeah. Wilson's just sat there and he's just making eyes at her the whole time. You're like, steady on, mate.
And I think it plays into kind of the thesis of Ray Kroc in this film, which is, and I think it's Dick McDonald who says it to him, where he's like, Yeah, if you can't beat them, buy them. But then, like, I think Ray kind of to the effect says, like, I knew the moment I walked in that, like, I set eyes on that place that I wanted it, and it's kind of like, that's exactly the same approach that encroaches, and it's kind of that thing. I think that's what the film is doing. It's like his business life. Really just corrupted his personal life as well, to the fact that he stole another man's wife and stuff like that, and this is speculation on my part, but I imagine more so her than him, like in real life, may have felt more guilt than he would have done, because by the time of her passing, it's like donated millions and millions of dollars to charity. So yeah, so Joan Croc. I think we can thank Joan Croc. She donated $200 million to NPR. So
wow.
If you enjoy those little tiny desk performances, ladies and gentlemen, Joan Croc, you got to be thanking for those. I imagine she's probably kept NPR going for all these years. They're probably still living off that Joan Croc money.
I think you're right. Yeah, yeah.
That and the YouTube views of Anderson .Paak doing his tiny desk performance.
Oh, I love it. Amazing, and she's great. And to be fair, again, Linda Cardellini, I think, plays it really well. Doesn't suit blonde hair. That was quite a shock when she sort of pops up on screen. It's like, oh, I'm not used to that. But
yeah, I guess it's being accurate to the character.
And but then she's great though.
What about BJ Novak? He kind of, again, we get that moment of him, like when Ray's at the bank and like his eyes are lighting up when he's listening into the conversation. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, this is where I can step in.
I'm literally in the middle of, actually towards the end of another rewatch of The US Office. And just to see him pop up, it's like, hey, it's Ryan from The Office. Yeah. And you're right. Like his sort of moment of just sliding in and his whole pitch about owning the land upon which the burger is cooked is such a great moment, and you can't help but go, oh, that's genius,
but evil at the same time.
Like, it's evil, it's genius. Yeah,
he's got one of those faces where, like, I don't know, it's like he could play really sweet, but like you can also see like a devilishness to him where like there's almost like a distrust. So I think he's kind of perfect casting in that role, because at first you're like, or maybe he's going to kind of, I don't know, help like Ray get on the straight and narrow. And he's kind of, oh no, I'm basically going to give you the tools to decimate these people that you're working with and kind of take ultimate control.
Yeah, he's almost like a younger version of Ray, like the way he just slides in and is just like, here's your problem, bang, there's your solution, and doesn't seem to give any kind of consideration to the situation that he's in or the other people involved. It's just straight in with, do this. And I think actually, I'm pretty sure there's a moment in their conversation where Ray says, well, that would mean, and then he pauses, you know, and then he sort of looks at him and they have this sort of knowing look, like he almost doesn't want to admit what he's about to do and say out loud, that would mean I would have to basically screw over my business partners. But it's kind of like that little exchange that they share for a second. And the fact that, like you say, BJ is just kind of almost like shrugs it off and is like, yeah, and?
Yeah,
and there seems to be that sort of like kismet there. It's quite interesting.
Well, I think what the film does interestingly as well is it doesn't feel like a slow decline of the character either. It's quite a quick decline.
Yeah, it's
like,
quick.
It's the moment he gets that first whiff of like, well, the moment he is kind of the franchise manager, it's like he's a problem, and it's like you almost want to grab. More so, you just want to grab the McDonald brothers by the scruffs and be like, get out now! You know what I mean? Like, get out while you can. And he's like, you kind of have that with Dick's really skeptical and like gets more and more so every kind of time. And there's that kind of ongoing, like recurring bit of the film where like every phone call ends with a phone slam. And then like, you know, they're kind of at their end of their tether when it's Dick doing it as opposed to Ray doing it as well. And it's like, the tables have turned, and it's almost like, I think at that moment, in the film, you realize, oh shit, they're now on the back foot. Because all the time up until then, it's like they've been a sticking point in Ray's progression.
Yeah.
For good, kind of in moral standpoint, obviously, for Ray's standpoint, for bad. But then when they're getting frustrated and like at their wit's end, it's like, oh, now it's like they're on the decline. Like they're this is the beginning of the end for them as the kind of owners of McDonald's.
Big time, man. I tell you, when it sort of builds up to that scene where they're sat in the room with the lawyers and he says, oh, it's a handshake deal. I don't know about you. I was watching it through my fingers. You're just like, no, like after everything you've been through, like you're almost screaming at the table, like just walk out. Just say no deal. Sorry. And leave. But the fact that they do it and you're like,
there's like an added kicker as well. When you get to the end of the film and you get a bit of text on screen that reads, if they'd got their royalties, it would be worth $100 million a year at this point. What is it, they both like they got a check each for like $1.3 million, or that would have, I'm assuming that would have been each.
I think he said it after taxes it worked out like $1 million each, so you're like, that's a drop in the ocean. But it's not even about the money, is it? It's just the whole like handshake deal. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, it's just, oh, you can give him 1%. You can give him like 0.5% of this. Nah, I'm not going to do it. And you just think, wow, you're a monster.
Yeah. And you kind of know straight away as well, because it's kind of right after that scene, it's like one of like the lawyer there saying, so you can't use the name McDonald's whatsoever. Like that'd be a conflict of interest and like the signs being like taken down and stuff like that. And it's like, It's so heartbreaking.
Yeah, and like one of the final bits is him just setting up shop directly across the road from them, which is just like, wow, nail in the coffin just at the final moment there.
Yeah,
he's brutal.
He's a bad guy.
Yeah.
So is there anything else that we haven't mentioned, Harley, that you kind of wanted to bring up at all?
I'm having a quick look through my notes. Not really, no. I mean, it's just, I thought, again, I just thought it was a really interesting choice that they would go this way on this kind of movie. But I love that they did it. I love that it's this honest. Mm-hmm. I think it's a movie that more people should see. Like, if you're listening to this and you're like, oh, I've not seen it, give it a go. It's on Amazon Prime at the minute. Like, just check it out. I think it's just under 2 hours long. And it's just a really interesting bit of history, I think. It seems pretty faithful to the events of what happened. So if you just want a quick version of this, then you're not going to find anything better, are you?
I think the kind of the marketing, those kind of posters where it is like with the McDonald's M on it, stuff like that, may put some people off, because it is that thing of like, I don't want to watch the McDonald's movie. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I agree.
And like Michael Keaton looks quite triumphant on the front, and it's like, it's not the movie that you're going to watch here. It's like it's almost like an ironic title, because he's not the founder. And like he put that on, and he says in his speech at the end about like the first store to open, and lies about the fact it was the first one that he opened.
I was going to say, I love that final speech for that exact reason. You say all the stuff that's sprinkled in, like him saying the first store that was opened. The fact that his speech is essentially like lifted from that sort of self-help vinyl record that he's listening to at the start about persistence, which he's clearly taken the wrong message from as well, by the way. He's sort of just constantly lifting things as the movie goes on. Even like taking credit for the golden arches at one point and stuff like that. And so like you say, to have it come full circle in that speech at the end. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that all sort of blends into the title of the film, which is almost a little bit satirical in a way.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. It might have been lost on quite a few people sort of looking at it going, oh, what, the guy that started it? Yeah, not bothered. It's like, no. This is the con man. This is the guy that ripped it out from someone else.
I think it is that same, I remember the kind of chatter when The Social Network was coming out, and like people like scoffing at it going,
yes,
Facebook movie, oh, like, and then it's kind of, you watch that film, it's like, oh, this is like one of, this is like one of the best films of the 21st century. Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah, 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 exactly. And it's a very similar story to this one of like, no, there's more to it than you might think.
And yeah, and the person you're following isn't it.
Yeah,
isn't a nice guy. Like, do you know what I mean?
He's not the hero of the story. No.
No. Still waiting on that Social Network sequel because Mark Zuckerberg, not a guy, not a good guy.
I mean, there's a lot to follow up on, so yeah, exactly, that would be interesting.
Yeah. Old robot man. I did exist. I mean, I do exist.
I wonder if they'll do like a Tesla movie one day on sort of a similar vein. Who knows?
Oh, yeah, well, Musk, yeah. Oh.
That would be an interesting one.
From Musk till dawn.
Yeah, we need a few years of separation, I think, before we get there. But yeah, I see that happening.
I feel like we're only in kind of like the middle act at the moment with his kind of acquisition of Twitter and him really showing his ass to the world and kind of how much of a... How much of a madman he truly is, do you know what I mean? Considering he was somebody who was like... I think maybe he's trying to do good with the world. It's like, oh no. He is kind of like this Bond villain
in very thin disguise. I don't, because he's, you know, he's not as interesting as a Bond villain. I kind of feel like he's just, what I see is just an attention-starved child. He's just little. Like, look at me. Look, I've spent $1 billion buying friends and then all of the people leave.
Yeah.
And then he's wondering why... they're leaving and you're like, because you're not a nice person.
Yeah.
it's just kind of tragic.
I'm buying you a clubhouse and if you want to stay here and actually speak to your friends, you got to pay me every month. No, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to pay to be my best mate? No.
No one wants that. No. And anyone who does pay for it is a social pariah in my eyes.
Yeah, if you're one of those people, speak to us afterwards. We've got a bridge to sell you.
So, with the founder put to rest, wrapped up in its nice little packaging, delivered in speedy fashion, one thing we always do here, Harley, when we're looking at films is... look at some Coppola connections. Did you manage to find any Coppola connections within this film? Are there people who worked either in front of or behind the camera who've worked with the Coppolas elsewhere?
I will say that I really struggled with this aspect of it. Sorry? I'm literally flicking through my notes now. The only things I could really feel were some connections between old John Schwartzman and some of the cast of this film. So
let's have it.
I think Linda Cardellini was in A Simple Favor, and he was the cinematographer for that. And Laura Dern was in Jurassic World Dominion, which I will not hold against her, and he was the cinematographer for that. Which, yeah, unfortunate, but yeah, that's kind of the only one I could really find. I'd love to hear what you've got because I know you're amazing at this.
Well, I didn't do as much of a deep dive as I usually would, just because you know what? I haven't done this in a while, and I forgot about it until today. And then I was like, I kind of just picked stuff from what I had in my kind of memory bank. I didn't have the man hours to be able to put in. And I'm acutely I don't know, aware, or kind of, I always fear that this is the part of the podcast people enjoy the least, because it's like, oh, it's just somebody reading out a list of things he found on the internet. So John Lee Hancock also directed Saving Mr. Banks, which Jonathan Schwartzman was also a cinematographer on. You mentioned Linda Cardellini in A Simple Favor. And the one other one I've got is Laura Dern is also in Wild at Heart, starring alongside Nicolas Cage. That's the three I've got. So
nice.
Yeah, if I've missed any, you know what, guys? You do the research and let me know.
Yeah, absolutely.
So let's talk about rating this film the way that we do that here on this podcast. We talk about the perfect wine pairing. What would be the perfect wine pairing for the founder, Harley?
Well, I have actually come prepared with a wine on this occasion, so I bet this doesn't happen very often. I'm just going to make sure... on camera for you. So what That's I have lovely. Picked up is a bottle. It's a Portuguese wine. Nice. I'm going to try and make sure I'm pronouncing this correctly. I think it's called Aluado. And it is Alicante Bouchette. And it is really lovely. You can get it from Laithwaite's for, I just want to say around, I think I paid like 10, 11 pounds for it. So it's a mid-tier kind of thing.
Nice.
And that's why I picked it for this, because I thought it's a mid-tier wine for a mid-tier kind of movie. This wine pretty much goes with anything.
Oh, nice.
If you want to have a McDonald's, you want to have a Big Mac and have a glass of this, I would recommend it. I'm sure it would be fine.
Is it red or white?
It's a red. Yes, it's a red.
Lovely really, stuff.
Yeah, I'm more of a red, I have to say, more of a red guy. Yeah, it's a really nice wine. I would highly recommend it. I can send you a picture if you want for socials later. Have you ever had anyone bring a wine to this, by the way, before?
Well, I did a mini series on the TV series. Well, I did a complete season recap of The Offer, the television series all about the making of The Godfather. And me and my co-host for that series every week drank a different bottle of wine whilst we were recording.
Nice.
So yeah, I've done it myself. People have been very specific in their choices. Cool. I think a red goes with this, because red goes with beef, right? And
exactly.
Not does this film just have beef in its burgers, it has beef between Ray Kroc and the McDonald brothers and kind of the many other people that Ray Kroc screws over throughout his kind of move-ins and shake-ins to becoming the kind of overlord of the McDonald's empire. So you've kind of shown your cards already, and you said that this is very much a mid-shelf wine and a mid-shelf film. I've got to agree with you. I think this is the kind of the perfect three-star movie. This kind of isn't kind of going to change your world, but I think it's going to definitely entertain you and pass 2 hours of your life in an enjoyable fashion, which is sometimes,
absolutely.
To be honest, that's all you can ask for sometimes, right? It's like,
absolutely.
I'll take that over something that's going to, I don't know, change my perception of the world through cinema. Like sometimes, sometimes you've got to be in the mood for that. I kind of feel like I'd be in the mood for this, like a McDonald's, more than I would care to admit.
Well, there you go.
So, Harley, based on this film alone, are the Coplas the greatest film family of all time?
It's a really good question. Based on this film alone, I would say no, because it's kind of, there's not anything particularly special at play here, but they're not the worst either. Like, it's a solid movie, as we said, so it's fine. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it leads me on to possibly my favourite question I ask people, because it either makes, they're either steadfast, they've had time to think about this, and they're kind of, they come straight from the gut with something, or it was absolute agony for them, and that is, which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so you get rid of the entire filmographies of the rest of the collective family?
I've been dreading this question.
Yes.
I was out for lunch with my wife early, and I was talking to her about this. I said, I don't know what I'm going to say for this. Because here's my dilemma, right? I'm not the biggest Nick Cage fan yet. I haven't had the chance to go through his filmography, but I appreciate him for what he is in cinema. And that he is a unique vessel. And I feel like there's so much stuff there. It's like, I don't want to erase that, but also I genuinely love The Godfather Part 1 and Part 2 in particular. I also really love Talia Shire in the Rocky franchise. So if I'm just going to kind of unpack that, Talia Shire is great, but I would assume with the absolute determination that Sly had for Rocky, worst case scenario, if she wasn't around, he would have made the film anyway and cast somebody else. So I'm going to pretend that that still exists.
I think you're missing the cheat code. You're skirting around the cheat code here.
What's the cheat code? Go on.
No. You give me your answer, and I'll tell you afterwards.
All right. I'm going to feel like an absolute fool. Well, that's fine. Man. Yeah, I'm probably going to go with, I'm going to keep Nick Cage, just because he's such a fascinating character. And I do genuinely love some of his movies. There's a lot more that I need to check out for him. So I will hang on. As much as, again, I really like The Godfather. I feel like, again, it's a really great book. I'm sure someone else would have adapted it at some point. Will it have been of good in an alternative universe? Maybe not. But yeah, I'm just going to stick with that. I feel like it's a safe answer, but yeah.
Oh,
what's the cheat code? I really want to know. What's the cheat code?
It's Talia Shire, because Talia Shire, you get to keep Godfathers Part 1 and 2, and you get to keep the Rocky franchise.
Oh, that hurts. Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm genuinely devastated that I missed that, but no, there you go.
Yeah.
Sorry, everyone.
Friend of the podcast, a previous guest, and he's been on your podcast as well. Andy Godian picked Talia Shire on that basis alone, because he's a massive Rocky fan.
Didn't he?
And
yes, Andy, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, Andy, if you're listening to this.
Yeah,
you're a better man than me. You figured it out. Oh my goodness!
Some people have done the workings out, and we managed. They've managed to stumble upon that.
What's
one.
That? Was that on the episode where he was on, you guys talking about the Amazing Spider-Man?
Yes, another John Schwartzman.
It was. I listened to that as well. Like, I should have known that. I'm so sorry. I'm genuinely devastated by that.
Don't worry. The only person you've let down here, Harley, is yourself. Don't apologize to me, okay?
I do that on a daily basis, so that's fine. Never mind.
You want to take a long, hard stare in a mirror tonight. And
I'll be opening this bottle and reflecting hard on my life. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, let me ask you maybe the most important question on this podcast, which is, what does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
I mean, I'm prepared for this, and I think after everything we've discussed, there's only one answer. Would you like fries with that?
Oh, yes. I love
Thank
it.
You.
I love
Thank
it.
Thank you, and good night.
With that perfect answer, where is the best place to find you and your podcast and everything you do, Harley?
Thank you so much, Petros. It's been an absolute delight. The best place to find me is Fundamentals Podcast. You just search that in any of your podcasts. I'm assuming if you're listening to this on Spotify, Apple, Podchaser, so on and so forth, I'm more than likely there. You can also find me on Instagram and Twitter at Fundamentals Pod. I don't really tend to hang out on Instagram all that much. Twitter's probably the best place to reach me. I'm also at Harley Mumford on Twitter if you want to go and say hi. And fundamentalspod@yahoo.com if you want to send me an email. Best place to go and have a look. I will be bringing this podcast. It is on a hiatus at the minute, but it will be back likely around the same time that this comes out. So make sure you check that out.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Harley, for coming and making some Copal connections with me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And there we go, guys. That was episode 59, and that was The Founder. Thank you once again for listening, and a massive thank you once more to Harley Mumford for coming and joining me and making some Copla connections. If you haven't already, please do check out Harley's amazing podcast, Fundamentals, which I have guested on before, talking all about my love of all things Seinfeld, and we'll be on in the near future once I pull my finger out and figure out what passion I want to go on there and talk about. It's kind of given limitations, I'm great. Given the option to talk about anything I want to, I absolutely crumble. If you have any suggestions of what I can talk about, please don't hesitate to get in touch. So you can grab me on all the socials. So that is Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Facebook, and TikTok, all at CagedInPod. Or you can drop me an email, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. And I really would like to, if there's anything I've talked about on this podcast, which you think, you know what? Petros is pretty knowledgeable about that. He kind of goes into it on those things. Like, let me know what I could talk about. And if you're not sick of my voice and would like to hear me elsewhere, you can do so on a fantastic podcast I had the absolute pleasure of being asked to guest on. It's Stephanie Joy Hubbard's amazing soundtrack journey. If you're unaware of this podcast, what Stephanie's doing over there, she's getting creatives, if I can call myself creative, to come and talk about their life through a film soundtrack journey. So it's mainly needle drops. It's just kind of the tunes that soundtrack your life, but very specifically the movie of your life. So it could be an almost rose-tinted view of what the soundtrack to your life actually is. Yeah, through the medium of film, something that I'm massively passionate about, as I am music. So it's an absolute joy to be on that podcast, and you can find all the links to that in the show notes and check out previous episodes as previous guest of this here podcast, a real early guest of this. Todd Jordan was the first episode, which is fantastic. I'm the third guest out of the gate, and I'm absolutely delighted that I'm on there, so do check that out. It's probably one of the most personal stories and stuff like that I've ever told on a podcast. So yeah, do check it out if you want to kind of get to know me all that little bit better. As for next week on the podcast, I'll be talking to return guest, film critic and writer James King, all about Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides, which, if you do not know, is getting a fantastic 4K restoration and release via Studio Canal, which yeah, you may be able to win a couple of copies of them. I'm waiting back on a couple of emails, but it's looking pretty likely that you'll be able to win a copy of that on Blu-ray. 4K and Blu-ray. I imagine that it comes with both. Yeah, over on the socials. So I'll likely do one on Instagram, one on Twitter. Unfortunately, it'll be open only to UK entrants just because of region-specific stuff and all of the crazy stuff with posting stuff internationally and stuff like that. It's just all, it's coming out of my pocket, guys. Okay. So, yeah. So get involved on that. Keep up to date with the socials so you can see any of that fun stuff and kind of the ramblings of my mind as well. But yeah, come join me and James for that chat next week. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by heading over to patreon.com/CagedInPod, where for as little as $1, you could support the podcast. Or yeah, there's multiple tiers up there that would really help keep the lights on here on this podcast. I've got fun things planned for that. I've got a series coming up with Will Chich where we're going to be looking at some films that are kind of tangentially linked to Francis Ford Coppola in a weird way. So yeah, we'll be talking about that, and as soon as that is, the couple of first episodes are recorded and we're ready to launch that, I'll definitely let you know what that is. Again, I'll probably announce it on the socials and then on the podcast, depending on just at the same time probably. So yeah, do be sure to do that. But if you don't want to support the podcast financially, which is totally fine because we are living in a Costa del living crisis, as I saw recently on the internet, I totally get it. You can head on over though to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now and leave a lovely 5-star rating and review. And remember that when you do, please do tell me what Bill Murray says to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation, baby. So guys, I've been Petros Patsilivus, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.